Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. January 21st, 2017, episode 123, Quiet Before the Storm. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 123rd installment of the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. I am Kevin England, and I am happy you could join us. You know, if I'm not mistaken, I started this effort in 2012, and we're in 2018. It just dawned on me the other day how many years I've been doing this. In this episode, we are back to our regularly scheduled program. A normal format episode with a lot to go over. Beekeeping around here has been a little more philosophical lately, and so it is when winter is in full effect and we are not out in the hives. Sometimes this time of year we are in a workshop, but I haven't had any projects yet this off-season. I'm knocking around an idea to build a Polaroidoscope. Polaroid, huh? That's a little play on words. What I'm really referring to, the proper name is a polariscope. It's the one thing I had on my to-do list, but I haven't gotten around to it. But we still have a couple weeks of cold weather to get that in before I have to start getting hives whipped into shape. A Kevin moment. The reason I call it a polaroidoscope is that on the Master Beekeeper's test, they had one of those sitting in the lab, and they asked what it was. And I am telling you, I could not, for the life of me, figure out what the heck the thing was called. And I had just gone through that Honey video with Tim Schuler, and we had a long discussion, and I told him I wanted to make one, and he sent me plans for a polariscope. But staring at the thing, it could have been a vegetable. I had no idea what the heck it was called. It was so frustrating. End of Kevin moment, I suppose. Anyway, we've been teased lately with a few off-kilter days. But it sure seems to me that it has been a very cold winter as winters go, and we are finally starting to see a few tropical waves push back some of the Arctic chill that we've had since early December. And not for nothing, there's no doubt this year about hive beetles that are nestled in the ground being frozen out. That's always a concern, especially the further you go south. If you get some of those days where the ground hard freezes below the frost line, it kills all the hive beetles that are in the dirt, in the soil. And this year, pretty far south, a lot of hive beetles got wiped out. I cannot recall winter as of late where it was cold enough to freeze standing water. And the other day I saw a bunch of hockey players playing hockey on a frozen pond nearby. I got a little squeamish thinking about some of the ice rescue courses I've taken in my past life as a rescue guy while watching. But yes, as I said recently, it's been cold around here. But today's break in the weather, especially 52 degrees, I think I saw on a thermometer in the shade today, means winter is ending and I'm looking forward to it. Okay, it's winter and it's cold. Guess you could have figured that out. Let me turn to tell you something more useful. How about what we're going to talk about in this episode? Topic number one, all I want for Christmas is a new beehive. I'll discuss what one should do with the holiday hive they receive. Topic number two, honey water. Topic number three, an update to the New Jersey Department of Agriculture events, shenanigans, and things going on. I'll keep that one brief this time. Roundtable number one, give bees water now. And if you want to get those mite treatments in prior to brooding up, it's time. Roundtable number two, Quizlet flashcards. How can you test your knowledge? Roundtable number three, California beekeepers have been plagued by wildfires. Just a quick little coverage on that. Roundtable number four, packing pollen. How they do it. It's It's a neat little ditty. Roundtable number 5, some upcoming meetings, things that are going on. Roundtable number 6, I throw in a recap, just a short one, of Solomon Parker's treatment-free seminar that was in Berks County. And then I have some closing comments to end the episode out. So, yeah, lots of stuff going on. And I guess it is time to head into the local Hive Report. Let's go ahead and get this thing going. For the local Hive Report, Sharon and I spent a moment of time yesterday walking the edge of our property where our hives are and peeking in on each of the colonies. The one hive that I predicted is a monster was simply teeming with bees at the entrance. There was no doubt it is looking forward to warmer weather. Next to it was the exact opposite. It was the sad, dead-out, full colony, and it saw some bees coming and going after inspecting what was going on inside, but this is the hive that had a broodminder on it, and I know that it is not alive anymore. I taped that hive shut after I shooed away the bees that were coming and going because I don't want anyone meandering in there, and sooner or later I'll get a chance to break it down. Kevin moment. I think last year I did something about doing forensics on these. Maybe I need to expand on that. I could do forensic on that hive. And by the way, there's a great article from Honeybee Suite. Rusty has a really good feature on doing forensics on a hive. But the question is, once you do forensics and you figure out what happened to the hive, what do you do with the equipment afterwards? How do you get it from that time period where the hive didn't make it to the time period where you want to put it back into service? What happens in between there? End of Kevin moment. So it was obvious, standing in the yard, that two hives of the five were surely alive. The second hive doing its thing was the left nuke in the two nukes sitting side by side in my little mini nuke condo. They were insulated, or should I say they should be insulated. The problem is that the insulation fell off. When I put the insulation up, I taped the corners using blue painter's tape. And it got really, really windy, and I guess the force of it was enough to tear the insulation off. And so normally it would hold, but that tape is low tack, so it doesn't pull off paint. And in this case, it just apparently got in between and was able to pull it off. So Friday morning, I went to go to work, and I looked out the window to check on the hives, and I saw the insulation laying on the ground and knew that come Saturday, when it was going to be 50 degrees, I would go out there and put it all together. So Sharon and I held the insulation, taped it really well to the boxes first, and then went around it multiple times, and I can assure you it's not going to fall off anymore. So that's twice this winter that the insulation tape fell off. So note to self, when you put that insulation tape on, you know, or if you're taping insulation to a hive or figuring out how to do it, make sure you secure it. Most people are using straps. I use tape. I probably should consider doing straps next time. Anyway. So as to the right nuke, well, I'm not sure that it made it, but I cannot tell. Dumb me. We put the insulation on. And then realized that, you know, maybe we should have looked to see if that hive was alive. I thought the hive was alive a little while ago because I saw dead bees at the entrance, and that usually means a sign that they're bringing out dead bees. But in this case, there was no activity, and looking at it, I thought, well, maybe the thing succumbed and it's not alive. Hold on to that thought, and I'll tell you a new idea about that in a second. We finished the insulation. Sharon wandered off with the dog, and I walked over to hive on position 1. It's a colony that's housed in boxes made from red cedar that this hive I won in a raffle once. And you know what? I seem to think, this is a Kevin moment, every time I've tried to overwinter that hive, it's never made it. And I don't think it has anything to do with what it's made out of, but that's an interesting idea. I wonder if I'll have to go back and look through my notes on that. So I was pretty sure that the hive was dead, and since it was 50 degrees and not 5 degrees, I was not hesitant this time to loosen up the strap and pop the top lid off. I think I could call it confirmed. No activity in the box was barren. So I'll pull it apart at some other time, and that makes two down confirmed. Now to the gateway hive. This hive in particular has been going for years. This hive started from a split provision from Charlie Ilsley back in 2014. When I first got it, well, there's no way to say it other than it was moderately nasty and fairly aggressive at times. But it was a prolific producer. I would always have a bit of caution with it whenever I was working, because if you jostled it the wrong way, it would come out and enforce, defend the hive. I thought about pinching the queen in early days, but I knew back then I wasn't as diligent about working my bees in times that were conducive to happy colonies. And I thought maybe that's why they were not so nice, and I should get better at working during the middle of the day instead of coming home and working my bees at night and things like that. Since 2014, this hive has been split numerous times, and I believed it may have swarmed once or twice. It certainly does not have the original queen, but it just keeps chugging along. The funny thing is, I've become fond of it. I was really dismayed standing there in front of it, seeing no flight or activity at the entrance. I thought the hive was dead. So Sharon and the dog walked down the row, and I held my breath while proverbially ripping off the Band-Aid to see whether or not the hive was alive or not. I loosened the strap, I pulled back the lid, and I peeked underneath, and darn if I didn't see a huge cluster underneath the little hole for the inner cover. You could have knocked me over, because there was nothing going on at the entrance where the other hive was flying, and it was 50 degrees. It's a curiosity. So why does a hive full of bees on a super warm day, the first one in whatever, not do their cleansing flights? Now, maybe I missed it. Maybe they were out in droves earlier, but you would think somebody'd be coming and going, and nobody was coming and going. I thought that rather interesting. If someone could have captured the moment, I'm sure it would have been priceless. They're alive! I shouted down to Sharon, who was down the tree line, peeking in on the Waray hive. I'm confident our hives have enough food to make it to spring. They're all pretty heavy going in, so I didn't really check their weights. I walked to the next hives on the far side of the tree row, down by the road that runs along the front of our property. Four out of the five hives were flying, and my assumption that the first hive in the row did not survive was correct from the last assessment. Four out of five, not bad on that end. I'm a bit disappointed at the hive that did not make it, as it was a split from the gateway hive, and I would be curious to see what happened inside when I do my forensics. Of course, the answer is mites, but I did treat that hive, along with the other ones, with oxalic acid vapors late in the season. Did all my hives in November when they should have been mostly broodless. But for some reason, that one did not pull through, and I have to peek in and see if I can determine what was different. As usual, with winter observations, the strongest hive flying yesterday morning was the polystyrene. Did I mention that I simply love that hive for overwintering? Last but not least was the Waray hive. Sharon, Julia, our dog, and I wandered over to see how the hive was progressing. I've been thinking a lot on this hive, as it has three boxes, and they only occupy the top two. Going into winter, there was quite a few bees in all the boxes, but when they got on the cluster, they consolidated to the top two boxes, and the bottom one was empty. What I toiled on was, should I pull the bottom box out of the stack and consolidate the space? Many nights, when it was 5 degrees and the wind chimes were tinkling outside, I had reservations of doubt about not taking that action. I did rationalize that it would be pretty disruptive to pull that box out in the bitter cold, and better to leave them with it than try to dismantle the hive for my own sanity's sake. So with a bit of angst, I wrote it out, and the outcome was the hive is in great shape. It looks amazing. Given it was a touch warmer during this inspection, I could see that when I removed the outer covers, the bees were spread out behind the glass and occupying the full top two boxes. In contrast, when I looked at them on a super cold day, they were collapsed into the four or five frames in the middle and were not out to the outside edges. Here, when I looked in on the glass, they were spread across all of the comb, left and right, top and bottom in box three and box two. Now, what was interesting, I wondered if they had spread down to the bottom, and they did not. The bottom box was still empty. The thing that I think had going for it is the entrance is closed down except for two little holes, a bee width space. So I think it's got a reasonable amount of ventilation with the quilt box on top. And they looked pretty happy in there. Quite a good bee, you know, good amount of bees, large population. It was a great way to end the peek in on that hive status. In the end, eight hives confirmed up and running out of 12. It's possible that that second nuke is still there. So now I come back to about the thoughts on the second nuke. I thought the gateway hive was dead. If you would have looked at it from the outside, you would have thought for sure it was dead. And I was surprised to find the full cluster. I just assumed at 50 degrees that all the hives would be flying. So now I have my thoughts. Maybe I should take the borescope and go back to that second hive and see if that second nuke is alive. I really can't tell. I didn't want to crack it open or mess with the insulation after we had just put it all back together, but perhaps I'll sneak back there at some point and take a look. I hustled out of the yard, reasonably happy about the outcome and excited because when you see bees flying, you can sense that spring is around the corner. Local hive report, check. I'm okay with it. I do not want to see 50% hive loss, but I'll take what nature's going to offer me. And I have some more to say about that in upcoming, I'm thinking through what I'm going to say next, some things coming up. So let's close down the local hive report. Topic number one, let's talk about the holiday hive. It is that time of year where new beekeepers, prospective beekeepers, I classify them in three ways. One, somebody who decided for a holiday and asked implicitly for hive equipment and they're trying to get started. This person's probably better off than most because they want to and they anticipated and therefore they're probably doing some research and they're excited about getting into the world of beekeeping. Number two is somebody who had casually mentioned beekeeping, thought about it, decided they might want to try it, and so on. But they were sitting on the fence, and then all of a sudden, for the holiday season, they got a beekeeping kit, and now they have to figure out what to do with it. And number three is somebody who had no idea, and all of a sudden, they have a holiday kit, and they're not quite sure that this is for them. And it's probably sitting over in the corner, and it may or may not see service for the holidays. So let's talk about these three folks and give them some guidance because as beekeepers, chances are somewhere along the line, if they know you're a beekeeper, they're going to turn to you and ask what they should do first. I'll start with saying a good place to start is the Beekeeper's Corner Getting Started in Beekeeping Guide. It's not really meant to be a plug because honestly, I wasn't trying to sell anything, so my motives are simply to give people advice on how to get started in beekeeping. If you go to bkcorner.org, our website, and look on the front page, there's a Getting Started in Beekeeping Guide. And if you, I've said this over and over again on the podcast when I talk about it, if you had the chance to sit with me and ask me how to get started in beekeeping, this is what I would tell you. And in this case, you're not purchasing equipment. You already have it. But hearing what I have to say about the equipment you should start with and the equipment you really didn't need that maybe you got and what to do with it, it would be useful one way or another. So I would recommend taking a look at that. Actually, You can look at it, meaning read it, in a PDF, or listen to it if you want to listen to it in an audio format. One of the things it says in there is to join a beekeeper's club, and I still agree that that's a great way to get started. But one of the main things you're looking at this point, besides purchasing bees, which, by the way, is in there too, is building equipment. And so let me talk a minute about that aspect. Of course, one of the things you'll do is build your equipment, meaning the boxes and the frames. They require assembly unless somebody purchased you a fully built kit. I would recommend you start with boxes first. And there's two important objectives when building a hive box. One of them is to get them square and flat, and the other one is to paint them properly so they last and stand the test of time. On the square and flat, the key recommendation is you need a square, meaning a metal ruler thing that's square that you put to the corners to ensure that your box is square. If you're not good at carpentry, a square goes a long way in making sure that the box is, well, square. And it's important because when you put one box over top of the other one, if you get them square and true, they don't have that twist and they sit literally on top of each other, which is paramount to important when you're building hive equipment. Now, hive boxes, the literal boxes, get built first. And the reason I say that is because after you build frames and you have frames laying all over the place, it's convenient to put them in a hive box that's already assembled. Assemble your hive boxes. Most of the time, anybody will recommend that you nail them together and glue them at the joints. I have a different approach, honestly. I never glue my boxes, but that's not common wisdom. I usually use, and it's a little more expensive, finishing screws. They're very similar to a screw that you would use to put up sheetrock, but they're really skinny and they have a very small head. Smaller than, say, a typical nail. The reason I like them is that they go in using a square head bit, and then if somewhere down the road, and I have done this, if you have to unassemble a box and replace a panel, one of the four sides, because it's damaged or rotted or whatever, you can unscrew them and take the box apart. Now, if you glue and screw, then obviously you can't take them apart because once you glue stuff, you're done. Recommendation for most beekeepers is to nail and glue the boxes. And I'm all good with tradition. One other tip that I would say, though, is that even if you were going to nail and glue a hive box together, it's still not a bad idea to consider using these finishing screws. Here's what I mean by that. If you glue all the joints, and the way that they typically do this, and you can go to youtube.com/NWNJBA and look for a hive building box video that we have. We'll give you recommendations. You squirt the glue inside each joint, and you take a little brush and you cover them, and then you tap the boxes together with a mallet of some form. And then you nail them together. And a lot of times what I find, especially if you're not adept at woodworking, is that the boxes don't stay square when you're hammering on them. And what I would suggest is when you're screwing them with a finishing screw, and again, you can find a video on that, my advice there, and see the screws that I'm talking about, another separate video on our YouTube channel. If you glue the boxes and fit them together, and you use a couple screws just to hold them in place, and then you nail all of the joints, and you back the screws out and put nails in where the screws were, I think you have a better chance of getting the box square first shot. Because when you drive that screw in, it's not like hammering on it, which sometimes takes the box out of square. Does that make sense? If you're a woodworker, and even if you're not, it probably makes sense. Hope that conveyed properly. There's a couple other tips about making equipment. Once you have your box built, Take it and set it on a concrete floor in your garage or someplace that you know is flat and make sure the box doesn't have a twist. Do that right away. After you've nailed it and screwed it, you should put it down and make sure that it's flat. If it has some sort of twist to it, you will curse yourself forever and you should figure out how to fix it. How do you fix a box that has a twist in it when you've nailed and glued it? I don't have a good answer for that, other than to take it apart. And typically when you try to take one of those apart, you can't. So, hence the reason why it's really important to get it square and true. What I have seen people do when they have a box that has a twist to it is they shave it off in some way, but that gets you into other trouble with the frame game, which is another video that we have, but I'm not going to go there. So now you get to the point where you want to build frames. Again, go to our YouTube channel and look for videos on that. I would suggest you do a frame jig. If you've never heard of one of them, look at the video. It tells you how to build a bunch of them together, and it's far easier than building them one at a time. And it gives you a lot more dexterity in trying to nail the frames together and glue them and do that part. So, you know, again, if you've gotten a holiday kit and you're not sure what you're getting yourself into, these are a lot of sage tips and tricks, and these things are out there on the internet. I went to a seminar yesterday on how to take photography for racing. And one of the advice topics that the photographer gave, that I will say the same thing, is YouTube is your friend. It's amazing how many times people run across a problem, they find a solution to it, and they stick up a camera and take a video of it, and you can find answers to just about anything out there. So when it comes to anything that I haven't shared with you, consider looking at YouTube and look at our catalog of videos, because a lot of times the stuff that we've created is to help people get past some of the difficulties they might encounter. The next thing you're going to wonder is where to get your bees, and now is the time. In January, you want to start getting your order in. A lot of people will order either a package, which is 3 pounds of bees or more that come in a box, or a nucleus colony, which is a smaller hive in miniature. It's usually 5 frames, but there is such thing as 4-frame and 3-frame nucleus colony, or nukes as they're referred to. Visit the New Jersey Beekeepers website, njbeekeepers.org, or whatever your local beekeepers association is. My recommendation is start with the State Beekeepers Association or your local beekeepers association. They'll give you good advice on where to get bees for your particular area. One thing to keep in mind, it's not the end of the world, but when you're buying bees out of Georgia and you live in northern New Jersey or Vermont or wherever you may be, the bees may not be situated for your climate, so to speak. So sometimes it is better to buy local, but the thing with buying local is nuke producers only produce so many, and if you don't get your order in early, you're not going to get hives or bees from those people. So don't procrastinate on this. So you have your boxes built, you have your frames built, you have an idea of where to get bees. One of the things you're going to want to do, it's the second thing that I had said you need to pay attention to, is painting your hives properly. I'm not a fan of painting hives in the wintertime. I don't know if you want to be painting hives in your house. If you have a climate-controlled garage, that works too, but the fumes and so on, even if it's latex inside of a house, is a little bit dodgy. It's always nice to paint on a clean spring warm day and put your hives out in the sun and let them dry properly. One of the things you do want to do, though, is paint your boxes in time where they cure or harden prior to putting bees in them. So it's really not a good idea to procrastinate and wait until the literal end when you're ready to just put bees in to paint them the day before or the week before. So sometime in the next couple weeks when it warms up and you get a string of warm days and it's not going to rain, make sure you give your hives a couple
good coats of quality primer. I typically do two primer, two out top coat. Paint them whatever color you want. Light on the first coat of primer and then a little more substantial on the second. Same thing with the outer coat. There is a school of thought of whether you paint your equipment before you put it together, but most people do paint it after. That is one detriment to painting your hives and then screwing them together and hoping you'll get them apart, because when you screw them together and take them apart, they tend to tear at the paint. A lot of times, if you've seen some of my videos of when I screw them, I paint my hives before I assemble them. It's a little bit fussy to do it that way, but I think it ends up with a cleaner process, so to speak. You know, one of the great things about working on hive equipment and banging and building things is the sense of accomplishment, and it goes better with friends. We did ours, and we invited friends over who were not beekeepers, and they came and helped us. So if you have a friend, consider having a little party and doing it. If anything, invite the cat in, because our cat climbed in and out of all the boxes as we were making them. Take your time and take pictures. It's so much fun to document your history of doing this, building equipment and things like that, and you want to have something to show for it. So whether you got a new kit or you hear from somebody who got a new kit, enjoy the process. Have fun. Welcome to beekeeping, or welcome them to beekeeping. They'll appreciate you giving them some words of wisdom and giving them help. And that's what it's all about as beekeepers. We want to help each other. Topic number two, round table honey water. We all know the benefits of honey being beekeepers, but do we recognize the sheer potential of a good idea when it is sitting under our noses? Nestle purchased the Poland Spring Water Company from Perrier in 1992 after they purchased the company in 1980. By the way, I think that Nestle just got purchased in the U.S. That's what I remember seeing going across my news feed. Prior to 1980, some enterprising individual in Maine had a conversation we're about to have. You know, I think I could bottle water and sell it for a profit. Someone smarter than that guy said to him, yeah, good luck with that. I could walk over to the sink and get a glass of water just about anywhere I am in this world, so why in the world would I buy a plastic bottle with water in it? Today we have soda, tea, sports drinks, energy drinks, kombucha, coffee, coconut water, and just about anything you could think of for sale in a convenient package, including, of course, plain old water. So what if I could give you a tip on the next best thing? Picture it. A beloved product, simple, healthy, hydrating, less than 100 calories in a 10-ounce serving. It quenches thirst while giving you a boost of energy. It's antioxidant rich, vitamins A, C, and E, has no refined sugars or artificial sweeteners, and can be consumed hot or cold. Oh, and it has natural amino acids and enzymes. What would you pay for such a thing? What are we talking about? Why honey water? Honey health in a bottle. Take it before exercise. Take it after exercise to recover. Picture it. A hybrid thirst quencher and health booster that can be even more potent with some mix-ins. Imagine the product line. Infused with ginger or perhaps some antioxidant teas, lightly refreshed with some mint or lemon. The potential for these bee-friendly drinks that can pull at our heartstrings are immense, and if you can promote coconut water as a magic elixir, even though some people don't like that taste, what could go wrong with honey water? By the way, it is a little too rich for my taste, but I have nothing against coconut water. There are brands emerging, and a cottage industry in healthy hydrators is trending. in the UK, in Canada, in New Jersey. Yes, I said New Jersey. Brands are clamoring for what might become a huge market. According to an article I read that led me to this discovery, it says, quote, honey enjoys a rare iconic status in the world of sweeteners. According to a Q1 2017 global data survey, 63% of U.S. consumers and 77% of consumers globally believe that honey has a positive impact on health. The only sweetener that a majority of consumers see in a positive health light. For perspective, 36% of Americans said that agave syrup or nectar has a positive impact on health. The next best sweetener, end quote. So who knew? Actually, you probably did know, but now you know in a different way. If you decide to take your honey business in a new direction and become the next healthy drinks magnet, after hearing this, please don't forget me when you get there. I'll be keeping an eye out for our New Jersey-based product called Bee's Water, just for the novelty of it. But, of course, I could source this amazing new discovery from spoils of my own victories. Well, one last thing before we move along. If you leave bee water sitting out in the sun for a bit, will it make mead? Think on that little ditty as we head to our next topic. Look for a link in our show notes for Is Honey Water the Silver Bullet for Full Sugared Soft Drinks? Today being January 21st, it is evident that we are past the January 19th deadline for submitting comments to the New Jersey Department of Agriculture. In starting topic number three, I wanted to talk about some of the latest events. Finished my comments and wrote a letter to Joseph Zoltowski, the director and key person at the Department of Agriculture. I decided at the end to make the letter really constructive and supportive. At the end of the day, I know these guys are just like us, every normal human being. They go to work, they do their job. They try to do it to the best of their ability. And I'm trying to take the high road. I get an impression when I went to the beekeepers meeting on Thursday night for Raritan Valley Beekeepers Association. Tim Schuler was presenting. And the purpose of going to that meeting was to take in a meeting and also have some conversations with Tim about Malawi. Ask him a couple questions in firming up my plans for the trip. The topic, of course, and Tim works for the Department of Agriculture, of the proposed regulations and the NJDOA approach came up. And one of the things Tim said, and I commend him for having to stand there in a room full of 30-plus people talking about the agency in a non-flattering light. He always takes a high road and represents their organization well. And if anything, that's an example to me that we should do the same thing. As beekeepers, we're going to have to work with these folks. And at the end of the day, they really are there to solve and look after agriculture. And if we make enemies, we're not going to win the war. So one of the things Tim was impressing upon people is, yes, send your comments. It was Thursday before the Friday. But make sure as you express what you're doing, you talk specifically about how it impacts you. And that's what I did. I'm impacted because I have to lose hives. And I need hives, or at least I prefer to have hives, so I can learn more and understand the different dynamics of the stuff that I have to teach. And because I like having more hives than two. I think the experience of having more hives, at least five, when you get your wings, so to speak, is the right answer. I submitted my comments, and at one point I'm thinking to myself, you know, I really wonder how many comments I wrote. So I started at the top of my Microsoft Word document, and I clicked next, 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 next to go through the comments. And when I got to 100 and something, I quit, and I know it was only about maybe a little over half to two-thirds of the way through the document. So My guess is I had over 200 comments. And like I said in the past, my comments got to more philosophical. They really helped me to understand at a deeper level the difficulties of what was proposed and how to say what was wrong and what should get attention. So to that end, another activity took place on the Tuesday night prior. Because I was the speaker of our local municipal request to put a resolution out, I got nominated to speak to the Hunterdon County Freeholders. And our association sent a message out and posted to Facebook and other places and asked for beekeepers to come and support. And lo and behold, there were some 30-something beekeepers there. So the meeting was interesting. We sat down. I had my little spiel prepared. And the meeting opened with public comments in the way that the freeholders, which are equivalent to county administrators, for somebody not familiar with the freeholder term, they suggested that short, simple comments were in the first public comment period. And then those who wanted to say more, which is what my spiel would be, could speak in the second comment period. In the first comment period, a lady who walked in the door with a big poster thing stood up and started having a conversation about how the New Jersey Beekeepers Association and beekeepers in New Jersey was spreading false information and on a media blitz to dissuade people from doing the right thing, which was pass this regulation. So it turns out it was Therese White of Gladstone, one of the principal people that had been meeting with the New Jersey Department of Agriculture team and the New Jersey Beekeepers in League of Municipalities and Merrick when they were discussing the issue at the state level. Also speaking at that meeting was Judy Gleason, who I think was the other person. I'll use this word and I don't mean it that way, but the other person in opposition. Her comment was that the comment period for the regulations was up and we should let the comments go. And she tried to implore the 100 freeholders not to take action and adopt a resolution, but to wait until the comments came in. I said my little spiel, and then there were other comments from the public. And at some point, Therese got up and said, I don't understand what the big deal is for the beekeepers, that there is a waiver process, expedited waiver process, so they shouldn't have that much of a difficulty. She made a statement about two hive limitation and then quoted the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association site, which I thought was interesting. And I don't believe she understands that me, the person who had just done the spiel, is actually the webmaster. I didn't want to tell her that and didn't go there. But as she went on, she said, I don't understand what the big deal is about limiting beekeepers to two hives when the recommendation is that a beekeeper have two hives when they get started. So put a pin in that. We'll come back to that shortly. She said a couple other things. But at the end of the day, what was funny is, and I don't mean this disparaging her, I feel for her, is that her points were not relevant. They didn't make sense. And for the Department of Agriculture to hook on to this and write what they wrote doesn't make sense, because she just doesn't have her facts correct. And we had a far stronger argument from a subject matter expertise. The bottom line was they went through each of the freeholders and asked them if they would adopt, and they gave them the opportunity to comment. One of them talked about the Farm Bureau and three of their major objections and how he agreed with their summation of the regulations. The cool thing was my little spiel, my three major objections, were aligned to that. One of the freeholders indicated that they thought that if you have all these beekeepers in the room, and they are going to, on day one, be out of compliance, why didn't they just grandfather them? And this waiver process has no detail, and it doesn't make sense. To that end, somewhere when I got my second chance to speak in the meeting, after I gave my spiel, a bunch of people said their thing, and then I countered what Therese had said by offering different options or ideas about that. And one of the things I said was that this is going to be a huge impact to beekeepers who are not menaces to society. We did a poll at one of our beekeepers' meetings, 50 people present, and 49 of them said they would be impacted with reduction in hive. And then off the cuff, I turned to everybody who in the audience and said, let's see a show of hands. How many of you will see a hive reduction when this happens? And almost everybody in the room raised their hands. It was really evident that this is not good for agriculture, and that was the point I made. So they made that point also. The last freeholder comment that I'll talk about is the one that said Hunterdon County is primarily agriculture, and the restrictions of hive densities for this thing doesn't fit what we have. Now, we're not as open space as we used to be. A lot of people moved into Hunterdon County because we're halfway between New York and Philadelphia, and a lot of people commute daily to either one of those locations, plus Princeton and other places. But still, there's plenty of room in a lot of properties to host bees, and this just doesn't fit. And he also commented that didn't appreciate what it does to urban areas, and it just doesn't seem well thought through. So at the end of the day, it was interesting to be the voice of reason in this thing. And what I didn't know is at some point somebody stood up and took a photograph of me presenting, and it was in the local newspaper, and it had comments from me and so on. So that's a first opportunity in this type of situation where I've been quoted in the newspaper. It's kind of funny to see your name. And of course, that article, along with all the other articles of coverage, got shared across the internet for beekeepers in New Jersey. The final statement from the freeholder says it needs more work and opportunity to find the balance between beekeepers and non-beekeepers, and it was unanimously adopted by the freeholders. The resolution said in it, gentle strains of honeybees can be maintained without creating detriment to public health and safety. And in fact, the New Jersey Beekeepers Association has been keeping bees at Deer Path round Mountain Park for decades without one complaint of report or stinging. So it's really cool that our freeholders, one of them happened to mention that their family used to keep bees. They were with us on that, and that's comforting to know. So our Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association site had a lot of information that I posted to keep everybody up to speed. On Saturday morning, I converted it over to post-comment time. But people are still making visits to municipalities. There's one coming up in Clinton Township. I don't remember whether it's the town of or the township. This Tuesday. And people are still speaking with senators and representatives. So there's no reason to stop notifying. And I think people will continue to try and get the word out. Hopefully everybody did what they could about sending comments in. What I know, a lot of the beekeepers I spoke to, even my lovely wife, wrote a separate letter. So I think people were really moved to do something about this. And in the end, we're really hoping that it makes a difference. One of the more interesting things to do is go to njbeekeepers.com or .org, and visit the New Jersey Beekeepers Association website and see the response that was put up there. I'll warn you, it's multiple pages, but it looks very similar to a lot of the things that I found. And I sent my comments over to the Beekeepers Association so that they could see it, and they're collating what everybody sent in also. So www.njbeekeepers.org, right on the homepage, is a click here to see the response. While you're there, look at the New Jersey Beekeepers Association announcement for the 2018 winter meeting. It's a two-day event held Saturday and Sunday, February 17th and 18th, 2018. It's at the Windsor Ballroom and Conference Center in East Windsor, New Jersey. I like that they kept it in the Hamilton, East Windsor area. That's literally dead center in the state, and it gives good opportunity for people from Sussex or all the way down to Jersey Cape to get there. You can go to the website to register and see who's speaking. There's three or four EAS master beekeepers on the topic. Dr. David Gilley from William Patterson is speaking. Grant Stiles, one of the larger commercial providers in New Jersey, is there. And Landy Simone, another EAS master beekeeper, is going to lead a speakers roundtable. If I remember correctly, they changed it this year. It's a two-day event, and you can register for Saturday or Sunday only, in case you can only make one of the days. And if you happen to be a vendor, you can also sign up for a vendor space. I'll be there. If you want to say hello, come see us. We're really going to look forward to a fun meeting. So one last thing I guess I'll say is I booked my trip to Malawi. Bob Kloss is going with me. Talked him into it. Didn't have to twist his arm too much. Bob and I picked seats on the plane next to each other so we can have 15 hours of studying for Master Beekeeper on the way in and on the way out, among other things. So, yeah, that's a fun trip. Looking forward to getting out there and making a difference and seeing how it goes. And my intention is to bring all of my recording equipment and see what we can capture while I'm out there. So the NJDA, New Jersey Department of Agriculture proposal review, that period is over. We'll see what happens. We keep our fingers crossed. And like I said in the last episode, we really don't want this to go through. It would be horrible for this to be an established model anywhere, let alone in New Jersey. I'll certainly let you know if anything comes of it, but I suspect that there's going to be a long-running review, and it'll be a while before they surface and give us any insights as to what's going on. It seems like a good time to head to the back of the book, roundtable section, roundtable number one, public service announcement. It's time to put your water out for your bees. These first couple days when it gets warm and the bees fly, probably won't venture too far from the hive. Although today while we were walking down the road, we saw Jim Schmalz's hives flying. And as we were standing a couple hundred yards, we could see his bees flying past and landing on the mud. So I think they were out collecting water. This is the time of year where they may pick up some water to try and dilute honey, because yes, it is not unlikely that the middle of January, early February, they start raising some brood in preparation for getting ready for spring. So a simple bucket with some holes drilled in the side, a couple of corks or floating styrofoam peanuts will do the trick. There was a question at the Raritan Valley Beekeepers meeting about, do you put something in it? We've talked about this topic in the past. There's suggestions sometimes that you could put star anise in it, because that's what Tom Seeley says attracts the bees. There was also a question about whether you needed to use food-safe plastic. I don't think so. That was my answer. However, what I heard is that if you buy your buckets from Lowe's, that they are food-safe. So that's interesting to know. Along with the topic about water, one of the things that was discussed is early treatment for mites. If you're of that inclination, this is the time to do your springtime prior to brooding up treatment. And I hadn't given that much thought. And I know that Tim Schuller had recommended that this weekend, when it was warm here in New Jersey, 50 degrees, would be a good time to put your Apivar treatments in. I'm thinking that it's just a touch early. It takes 56 days for a treatment to run its course, if I remember correctly. And if 56 days from now takes us to about mid-March, and New Jersey our nectar flow starts sometime around April, and that's when you would put our honey supers on. So it's really close. The reason that I wonder is that bees are on the cluster. Like even now, it was 50 tonight or today, but tonight it's going to be 30 and the bees are going to be all clustered up. I think it'll take another week or two before they'll be in and about the hives. It's not a bad idea, but I think I'm going to wait one more week for another week of cold to pass us by, and then I'll do something with my treatments. So thinking about this time of year, some beekeeping management practices, those are some things that you should be keeping in mind. And believe me, the beekeeping season will be here in no time at all. So if you've procrastinated anything that you wanted to do in preparation for the season, you should be doing it now. Like we said earlier, if you want to paint your boxes and get them to cure properly, meaning they fully dry and the chemicals are evaporated out of the paints, which take a couple weeks, you're going to want to paint them early enough to give time for them to cure. So this is a time you should be thinking about those pre-season things and not waiting to the last minute. Roundtable number two, flashcards. As Bob Kloss and I are preparing ourselves for the Master Beekeepers Association, there's a certain amount of just repetition that helps you keep things straight. Now, we're looking for something a little bit different than the normal beekeeper person, but you know, sometimes it's always fun to test your knowledge, see how you do. I'm going to give you a web address, Quizlet.com. And if you go there and you perform a search on beekeeping, you'll find that a lot of people have put beekeeping flashcard quizzes in there. There is an iOS and Android app that you can download and search for beekeeping also. And if you find yourself looking to pass the time and you want to test your knowledge, you can do flashcard tests. And the interface is pretty good. I was doing some work on some study with it with a different one called Cram at cram.com. It crashed here or there, but for the most part, it worked really well. And what happened in Cram is that you test your things. Let's say you have 20 questions. If you get one wrong, it marks it wrong. And through the first round, as you go through, it keeps track of what you got right and what you got wrong. When you're done testing, you can go back to round two, and it feeds you all the questions that you got wrong right in order, and only the ones that you got wrong. And then if you get any of them wrong again, you go to round three, round four, whatever it takes to get them all right. And it's a really interesting and good way to study, and I enjoyed it. So anyway, Quizlet.com and Cram.com are the two resources that we found. Give them a try. Along that line, you can also go to your Alexa app. I think we've talked about that in the past. And say, Alexa, play beekeeping quiz. And you'll find that there's beekeeping quizzes built in. Or you can look at the skills that Alexa has, and you'll find other ones, I'm sure. So it's always fun to test your knowledge and see what you know in a fun and friendly way. Roundtable number three, to talk about the wildfires in California. December time frame, there were a lot of fires, and we don't have those on the east coast of New Jersey. All those folks in California, I feel for them. And there was an article in the USA Today, I think it was about mid-December, December 15th, 17th, something like that, where several beekeepers were awoken in the middle of the night, according to the story, to indicate that a fire had started nearby and they had to scramble at midnight to go move their hives. It sounds like they lost about half their colonies, and they go through the trials and tribulations of trying to be prepared for beepocalypse, is what I would call it. It's just got to be so disheartening to lose your hives that way. The article points out that beehives made of wax make incredible fires because of the way the wax burns. So I can only imagine that One, the wax melts all over the place, and you don't literally have to lose your hive consumed by fire. All there has to be is enough radiant heat nearby to cause a huge amount of damage. So as we think about all these wildfires that occur along the West Coast, we can give solace to lately they've been seeing rain and snow and things like that, and maybe these wildfires will tamp down. But to all our beekeeping friends out there in California, we feel for you. We wish you the best. We hope you didn't get impacted. And if you did get impacted, we hope you can find a way to get yourself back on your feet. As us folks from New Jersey and East Coasters, we don't know what it's all about, but we feel your pain. The story was covered for Mission Beekeeping. That's the name of the company. They had about 160 beehives in West Ventura. And of course, we can't forget about the firefighters who were doing yeoman's work out there, doing what they do every year, trying to deal with the wildfires and stuff. So I'll have a link to the USA Today story in the show notes. Roundtable number 4, packing pollen. In studying for the EAS Master Beekeeper's Test, we just finished, Bob and I, going through honeybee anatomical structures. In one such area of the thorax, we got into the details about legs and how they work and what happens with them. I came across an interesting sidebar that took me on a journey to learn how bees pack pollen in the corbicula. Say that 5 times fast. So pollen is swept off the bees by the legs. Pollen on the front legs is brushed off by the middle legs and then gathered on the basitarsi, which is a segment of the rear leg. The pollen's then taken by the back legs, and there are specialized rows of bristles on the inner surface areas of the basitarsi, referred to as pollen combs. There are 9 rows of bristles, which all point downwards. The 2 basitarsi of the back legs can be held in a way that they can face each other. The middle legs are pulled between the back legs, and the back legs catch the pollen through these bristles. As part of packing this pollen, bees add some nectar, which adds the ability for it to clump together. And they move their basitarsi up and down between each other, and the pollen is scraped off and squeezed into the gap between the tibia and the basitarsus. Once in the gap, the pollen is compressed by the actions of the muscles within the tibia pulling up on the basitarsus. This is referred to as the pollen press of the bee. The pressing forms the pollen into a paste, and it will squeeze through an outside channel of the leg where it meets the row of retaining hairs, which forces it to move upward to the outer surface of the tibia. Here, it is held in place by the hairs of the corbicula. So picture that. The 2 back legs come together. The middle leg is drawn through it. The pollen is gathered there. They use it rubbing against each other to move it in between the joints of the flat part of the back leg, which is like a paddle almost to me, and they squeeze it into a joint, and then the muscle packs it up, and what I think I understand is that it squeezes through that joint to the outside surface on the outside of the bee, and it's rolled up underneath the area where the corbicula is. And the corbicula is an area where certain hairs are shaped that can hold the pollen pellet. How cool is that? You don't think about it when you see these bees flying around with all this pollen on their legs as to how it actually gets there. At least I never did. And it was neat to discover that. So Honeybee Biology and Beekeeping, Dewey Caron's book, has a description of some of this, but not in the detail. And what I've been doing is reading the anatomy in Dewey's book and then going even further in understanding and being able to see the photos of the specific parts and pieces, even close-up, huge close-ups of different anatomy of the bee through microscope pictures in Understanding Bee Anatomy, a Full-Color Guide by Ian Stell. So the two complement each other. Dewey explains the basics, and Ian explains the detail. And I'm a little type A. I want to know how this stuff works. And if anybody ever asks, I want to be able to understand how this actually works. And I could say, hey, by the way, do you know how pollen is packed? And da-da-da. So a pollen press. Never heard of that until this point. And when I saw that, that prompted me to go take a look at it. So there you have it. How pollen is packed. Cool, right? Roundtable number 5. This is the Department of Things to Do. The 8th Annual Philadelphia Beekeepers Guild is coming up. Natural Beekeeping Symposium. Went to this last year. It was an amazing show. Amazing. This year, Saturday, February 10th, 8 a.m. to 5:45 p.m. It's at the Franklin Institute. Tom Seeley will be there. Tom is always amazing to listen to. Also, Leo Sharashkin, I believe is how you say his name. He's the natural beekeeping guy. He'll be presenting on day one, and then he is apparently the featured speaker on day two. PhillyBeekeepers.org is the website. I think Bob and I talked about going to this because we've gone to a bunch of these things together, but this year I'm going to pass because I see the two talks that Tom is giving, and I've seen both of them. And I'm interested in what Leo has to say, but fact of the matter is I really need to start studying. And I would be better served to spend my day focusing on EAS instead. February 3rd, looking at the Chester County Beekeepers Association website, they have County Flight Path Clash Mead Competition. At the Haymaker Meadery, Doylestown Road, Montgomeryville, Pennsylvania. Just opened a map to take a look at that. That's just the other side of Doylestown. It's about an hour ride for me. That's interesting. I'd have to consider that, but again, I have to reserve my days. What's more important for you to know is March 10th, 2018. 2018 Chesco Beekeeping Conference at Westchester University. Went to that last year. Really good program. I don't know that they announced what they're going to be covering, but a lot of EAS people tend to present there. Saw a great presentation from Landy Simone last year there. Of course, March 10th, I'll be flying home from Malawi, Africa that day, so I'm going to miss that one. Closer to home, this Friday, we have a beekeeping meeting for Northwest, our first one, January. We're covering bottling honey for the State Honey Show. Every year when the State Honey Show comes, they put a press out to get people to put honey in the show. And this year, even more so with the New Jersey Department of Agriculture stuff going on, it's important for us to show our wares at the State House or wherever they put it in the rotunda, and a lot of the state officials go past that area and see the honey display every year. What we really want them to be able to do is walk by and look up and go, there's a jar of honey from my hometown. So to that end, our association has encouraged our members to bring honey to the next meeting, and we're going to show them how to bottle it for a competition. And the State Honey Show Chair, Cynthia Wirtz, is coming to town to talk about how the show works and give some advice. And yours truly will be the guide to how to do the process. So I'm going to channel my inner Tim Schuler and all the things he taught us about how to do honey shows. That's this Friday night, 7 p.m., Hunterdon County Complex off of Route 12. The building that looks like a big chicken coop. That's what it's referred to affectionately around here. It has one of those slanted roofs that looks kind of funny. It has a mock silo out front. It's called Building 1 officially. And if you go to our website, you can get directions if anybody's interested in joining us. Bring some honey. So between these couple meetings, it's a good way to get yourself primed and get your mind set for the 2018 beekeeping season. I have to say that the Raritan Valley meeting and the conversations from Tim Schuler telling people what's going on and the questions from the audience really did shake the cobwebs a little bit about getting my act together for beekeeping this year.
Roundtable number 6, go treatment free.
And speaking of meetings, I wanted to make sure I mentioned that I went out to the Berks County area for the Solomon Parker talk. All day long, 12 to 6, Solomon gave a bunch of different talks. I think he had 5 of them scheduled. Let Them Die, the Case for Doing It the Hard Way. Starting Beekeeping Treatment Free. He talked about swarm trapping and the expansion methods and other topics. He answered question and answer. I won't go into any detail about what he spoke of because I took reasonable notes that day. And I'd like to have him in front and do a little recap of what he talked about. I got to meet Solomon, say hello to him. Ironically, he had no idea who I was. As a beekeeping podcaster, I find that kind of weird. But then again, he's on the other side of the world, meaning United States. Might as well be the other side of the world. And didn't know who I was. That's all right. I think it kind of freaked him out a little bit that he had another podcaster in his audience. He was a little cautious, I think, about what he said. Although I found it really interesting, and I have to say, I was impressed. I was really pleased with what he talked about. It was well organized, well thought through. And the questions that he got from the audience were somewhat challenging here and there. And he was spot on in his assessments of giving advice and explaining different things. So kudos to him. He had done his homework and did a really good job presenting. And I don't know what they paid to have him out there, but they certainly got their value because he did a great job and kept everything on track. I was curious to find out where he lived because he didn't know much detail about it, what his land was like, and how does that compare to the density of people in New Jersey. And it appears that based on his account, and I didn't get a chance to talk to him in any detail, it is pretty different. The densities here and the number of beekeepers in proximity to each other. He talked about keeping bees near the BLM, I think that's the acronym he used, which I would call the Bureau of Land Management. So it sounds like it's a little more open, but, you know, look, neither here nor there. It was a good talk, a good day, and I needed a day away from the world to just do nothing but listen to somebody else talk about beekeeping, something I didn't have to prep or prepare, and a different topic, and really did enjoy his program. Wish him a lot of luck on his talks and stuff that he does. And, you know, I told him I listened to his podcast. I appreciate what he puts out there. It's treatment-free beekeeping. You can go to parkerbees.com and see the talks that he offers. And also, I'm assuming out there he has links to his podcast and other things that he does. Somewhere along the day, he mentioned how many people subscribe to his podcast, and I'm sorry, to his Facebook page. It's a pretty impressive number. There's certainly a market out there in the world for people that want to be treatment-free. And I do believe that there's a place for treatment-free under the right conditions. There were certain sides of the talk during the day that I got a little squeamish, going, come on, you know, that doesn't float, but I was polite and kept my mouth shut on certain things. you know, but all in all, like I said, I don't want it to sound that way. He did a really good job, and I liked the way he presented the topic, and it had a really good cadence to it the whole day. Everything led to something else, and he was good to refer back to different things, and, you know, all in all, a really good talk. Well done, Solomon. Thanks for the day. And thanks to the Berks guys for the hospitality. I appreciate that. They knew who I was because they had invited me. I think they were surprised to see me. and had a nice chat with them about a couple things here and there and enjoyed the day and invited them to come out to our stuff. And if they have things going on, I wouldn't hesitate to drive back out there. It was near Reading, Pennsylvania, which in the grand scheme of things is pretty far to drive for a beekeeping meeting for me. However, it's 15 minutes shorter than the shortest racetrack that we go out to when we go racing in the summertime. And we literally drive past their area when we go out to Jonestown to race at Lynda Speedway. So to me, I didn't think it was that big of a deal. And I love to listen to audiobooks and rarely get the time to listen to large blocks at a time. So I audiobooked all the way out there. So thanks, Justin, for the invite. Really appreciate that. And keep me posted on stuff going on, and we'll keep in touch. So I think this is where I'm going to close the episode down. I'll let you in on a little secret. It's 9:30 at night, and I've been recording this thing since 3-something in the afternoon. I did take a break to make dinner, eat dinner, clean up after dinner, and a couple other things, but this is the first time using that new software and my new microphone, and still trying to figure out how to do different things in this software. It's been a maze. In between, I've been pulling up YouTube videos and trying to figure out how to work with the interface. I've learned so much today, but I have no idea how it sounds. And I'm not sure how yet to export it, but I guess I'll figure that out. And if you hear this, you know that I kind of figured that out. Ironically, I think what I'm going to try and do is export it out and then import it into Audacity, which I have a standard way to export out of there in the format that I need. Such is the life of podcast producers, to try and figure out the ins and outs. And eventually I'll figure out this tool and I'll be ninja with it. I'm not sure how well it shows. I've made a couple cut-ins here and there to fix errors. And I really believe that it's going to help, because the stupid little vocalizations and mistakes that I've made in the past where I just plowed through, it's pretty easy to go back and record over them. So I think my physical recording and topics will get a little cleaner, but we'll see. I'm still a pretty local, run-of-the-mill, do-it-yourselfer podcaster. So, but hopefully you appreciate the effort, and I'm curious to hear myself driving to work tomorrow as I listen to this, how the new microphone sounds and some of the other stuff. So we'll see. One of the funny things that I did during the middle of this was I drank a Diet Cranberry Ocean Spray because I was thirsty and there was one handy. Note to self, never drink cranberry juice while you record. It just dries your throat out really, really bad, and I sound terrible. But hey, live and learn. So with that wonderful piece of informative and insightful information, I guess I've done all the work that I need to do here today. So I'll say goodbye. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.